Thank you. So today I'm going to be talking about some joint work between the University of California, San Diego, and the University of Washington, where we looked at automotive security. So first, a review. Cars are no longer mere mechanical devices that they once were. Indeed, many aspects of cars are now controlled by tens to hundreds of computers that we call electronic control units, or ECUs, running millions of lines of code on a whole host of different architectures that are connected together by a number of shared buses. By connecting the computers together, cars have become safer and more efficient. However, this interconnectedness has come at a price. Last year at Oakland, we showed that if an attacker were able to get physical access to one of these buses, then many safety, in fact, all safety critical systems in the car could be compromised, including selectively enabling and disabling brakes, controlling all interior and exterior lights, and stopping the engine. We showed that taking control of one of a number of different ECUs was sufficient to completely compromise the car. In fact, many of these ECUs can be reprogrammed even while driving. So one consequence of this is that any compromised computer in the car can reprogram another computer, and then code can lie dormant until it is triggered at some later time. So in this talk, I'm going to first synthesize the attack surface of the modern automobile, and then as we in computer security know, there's a big difference between theoretical attacks against some attack surface and actual attacks. So I'm going to evaluate some attacks that we actually did against some of these surfaces. Then I'm going to talk about how, after we have compromised a car, we can control or trigger the malware that we have installed. And then discuss how, some evaluations of end-to-end attacks or real scenarios that are of interest today, in particular car theft and surveillance. And then finally, I'll discuss why we're in this situation. So first, this work is all about the threat model. And in particular, we considered attackers who had varying levels of capabilities in what they do, what access they had, what they could send, and then considered what sorts of components might be vulnerable. So the first of these that we looked at, we called indirect physical. Here, the attacker interacts not with the car itself, but with some physical object that does itself interact with the car. One example here is a diagnostic tool which plugs directly into the OBD2 port and then communicates, in many cases, wirelessly, Bluetooth or Wi-Fi, with a computer elsewhere. Many cars have media players that play a wide variety of formats, such as WMA or MP3, and of course, Redbook audio, and in some cases have iPod or USB connections. There are a number of third-party devices that plug directly into the OBD2 port and provide a variety of functionality. And we have charging stations for electronic cars. The next category of attacker we considered were those who were able to send short-range wireless communications. Typically, we were considering something about 100 meters or less. Bluetooth has become the de facto standard for hands-free communication, and many cars can pair with a phone to provide that functionality. Wireless tire pressure sensors spin around in the tires and periodically transmit data about the tire pressure to a receiver in the car. Of course, remote keyless entry provides several types of wireless communication. Some cars are now standard with Wi-Fi access points that can be used for internet access. And looking forward, we have vehicle-to-vehicle communications for things like crash avoidance. The final category that we considered was long-range wireless communication, where here we're considering attackers who are able to send signals over miles or even at a global scale. So we have a bunch of digital radio signals like HD radio or satellite radio that can transmit over a number of miles. And telematics units are becoming common in basically every car. Every manufacturer either has one or is making one. And these are used for things like roadside assistance or automatic crash reporting. So now I'm going to talk about several of these that we actually attacked. In particular, we were able to compromise the diagnostic tool, the media player, Bluetooth, and cellular. And to be clear, every single one of these that we looked at led to a complete car compromise, doing everything that we showed in the previous work, including doing things like disabling the brakes. So I'm just going to talk about three of these. But first, there's some. For each of these, we followed a general methodology. First, we would extract the device's firmware for the ECU that's responsible for a particular attack surface. And we could do this either by reading the memory out directly over the CAN bus using our custom tool CarShark, or in some cases we actually had to desolder the flash chips, which was usually a destructive operation, and stick them in a reader and then just read them out. With the firmware in hand, we disassembled the tools using the industry standard IDA Pro, and in some cases for which IDA Pro didn't actually support it, we had to write our own disassembly plugins so that we could see what was going on. Then we would just do the standard thing where we'd look for code that appeared to be vulnerable, try to produce an attack against it, and then finally weaponize it so that we could transfer it between the two groups in San Diego and Seattle and make sure that they worked on both of the cars that we had. So the first of these categories falls under an attacker who has an indirect physical access, and here we're looking at the media player. So our radio can play a number of types of file formats that are stored on the standard ISO 9660 file system. So the first thing we did was we looked for this code and we found two attacks. One, there's this vestigial radio reflashing code that it's not clear that the manufacturers even knew existed that allowed us to reflash the radio just by inserting a CD. And the second one was for parsing WMA files. We found a bug that led to a rather tricky overflow. It wasn't just like overflow on the stack and you write your exploit and you're good. Most of the time, the radio would just crash because the values that we were overwriting were actually really sensitive. So in an amazing feat of engineering and lack of sleep, my co-author Carl Kosher wrote an on-radio debugger basically in one night by repurposing an unused serial port on the device that we just soldered on. And then using this debugger, we were able to examine these values in memory. And then eventually, we constructed a WMA file that would play fine when played on a computer, but when burned to a CD and played in the car, would completely take over the radio and thus every component in the car that we wanted. The next category we looked at was short-range wireless. So in this case, Bluetooth. Our telematics unit provides hands-free headset functionality, and it uses a standard Bluetooth stack. And so we found the source code for this, and we noticed that there were a whole bunch of stir copies that weren't obviously safe. In fact, the very first one we looked at led to a trivial buffer overflow on the stack and thus could compromise the unit. So what we did was we built a Trojan that ran on an Android phone that was already paired with our car, and then it could just trigger this stir copy overflow and take control of the device. But this required that we had a phone that was already paired. So then we set out to see how hard was it to pair our own device with the car. And for this, we used a USRP-based software radio to sniff the Bluetooth MAC address, and then we were able to brute force the pin that gets produced for pairing requests. This actually took a significant amount of time due completely to the fact that the telematics unit was really slow to respond to pairing requests. However, after several hours we could do this, we could pair our own device, and interestingly enough, it was completely undetectable to the users. The device does not appear in the list of paired devices, and it can't be unpaired using the standard interface. So the final modality of attackers that we looked at was the long-range wireless, and in particular, our telematics unit contains a cell phone, like they all do. And this telematics unit has a communication stack that's got, you know, SSL, and so don't want to attack that. That's going to be a lot of work, or impossible maybe. But it turns out that for coverage reasons, They don't always use the 3G because, as you can see, it's not available everywhere. Instead, there's this second parallel communication stack that uses your standard CDMA or GSM, I'm not sure which, and then just treats it like it's an analog voice channel, on top of which they stick the standard software modem used in this space, which is a simple frequency shift keying software modem that produces some bits and then the telematics code uses. So for this, we looked at the software modem protocol, which wasn't public, but we were able to interpose on real communication using this and then hunt around in the signal for a known value. So here I think we have the station ID for the car. At the same time we were looking at this this protocol, we were also looking at the output of the software modem. So the data goes to the software modem, it gets demodulated or whatever, and passed along to the telematics unit. Now, at this point, the rest of the telematics code, and at this point, we noticed that there was a mismatch in assumptions. The vendor for the software modem had decided that we could have a rather large buffer, a rather large packet could be sent at one time, and the telematics code assumed that it was only going to receive a small bit of data at a particular time, and so it had a short buffer. And in fact, it was happy to just memcopy the entire length of the buffer from source to destination without checking that it actually fit. And so this led to a rather trivial buffer overflow. And so in the end, what this gives us is a way that we can just call the car and then transmit our malicious payload to it and take it over. We did this in two different ways. First, we implemented the software modem and handled all of the ACKs and so forth, the two-way communication, and we could take over the car. But then we noticed that we didn't actually have to do that. We could just record the data into a MP3 and then play our song right out of an iPod and directly into the phone, and this was sufficient to take over the car. All right, so now we've taken, what Ian? Play the song? It sounds like a modem. It's not exciting, I'm afraid. Okay, so now that we have taken over the car, let's consider what we can do once we have our own code sitting on there and waiting. The two wireless channels, or not the two channels, but rather all of the wireless channels, the short range, long range, all of those, they're game changers in the sense that now, as soon as you compromise the car, you don't have to launch your attack. You can just sit around and wait until some later point. And so we used a number of these to build basically four different types of triggers. We had proximity triggers, where if the car was within range of a transmitter, then it would trigger. Or it would do whatever its malicious code said it was supposed to do. We had a broadcast trigger that used the radio data system, which is used for displaying artist and track information on your radio when you're listening to it. And then we used Bluetooth and cellular for triggering for shorter long range. Now, it turns out that since our telematics unit has a 3G internet connection, we can actually do more. And so we did the sort of standard thing. We built an IRC client, installed it on our telematics unit, and then this provided a whole bunch of additional functionality. For one thing, we could use the IRC's DCC chat feature to get a shell on the telematics unit, and it's running a Unix-like operating system. Did I go back? I did. Sorry about that. And in fact, we could do more. We could use it to cause the cars to send individual CAN packets, either to have a single car send a packet on its internal bus, or we could have every car that's in the channel do it at the same time. So here at the top, this WWSXFSJ is the UW car joining our IRC channel. And then a little bit later, you see the UCSD car joining the channel. And then down at the bottom, you see Carl commanding both cars to simultaneously send a packet out over the bus. You'd have to ask him exactly what this one was, but I think this was just caused a chime to happen simultaneously in both cars. All right. So now we've developed a number of different capabilities. And so now I want to talk about how we can use these capabilities in sort of end-to-end scenarios to sort of real-world scenarios that people care about. And I mentioned them before, car theft and surveillance. So let's start with car theft. And here's more or less how this would work. You have your enterprising thief who goes out and compromises a whole bunch of cars and then finds the one that he wants using the GPS that the telematics unit conveniently has. Then he dispatches his accomplice to go to the car, and when he arrives, the thief commands the car to unlock its doors, start its engine, bypass all of its anti-theft measures, and then the accomplice can just drive away. And so we did this, and I'm going to show you a video where we're doing this. So here, Carl has been given the GPS coordinates, and he is going to walk out to our lovely car. The doors will unlock when he gets there. So here we are commanding it to steal away. Okay, he will get in, safety first, seatbelt goes on. And the anti-theft measures like the shift lock solenoid will be released so he can shift. And then he can drive away with no keys in the ignition. An earlier version of this paper, we considered titling an earlier version of this paper Gone in 60 Seconds, but, you know, I think that was 40, so it doesn't really work. So the next one is surveillance. And here it starts out the same. We compromise the car. But now we're gonna try to figure out where the car is using its GPS, but this time we're going to do it a little different. We're just going to have the car tell us. It's going to basically tweet its GPS coordinates that we're going to mash up with, well, why don't I just show you? And in addition, there's this microphone inside the cabin which is used for the hands-free calling. So all we have to do is sit around and wait until we hear some voices talking, and then we can just compress the audio and send it off to a remote server. So here, Carl and Alexi will be discussing something of extreme importance.
King Bowser's gonna be super excited that we finally kidnapped Yoshi.
Back in San Diego, I'm going to be using my Twitter Google Maps mashup and notice that the car started moving. And so I'm going to enable the audio exfiltration. And after a few seconds due to buffering, we'll get to hear them talk. And remember, this audio is from my computer 1,500 miles away. This audio.
King Bowser's gonna be super excited that we finally kidnapped Yoshi.
Yes, but you know there's more than one of them.
Oh, I guess you're right. There's what, a red Yoshi, a yellow Yoshi, and a blue Yoshi?
I hear there's also a Kono Yoshi. We should get all of them.
Excellent.
Okay. So, all right, so let's take a step back and try to figure out why we have this state of affairs today. And I think there are basically two reasons, and the most important of which is that there has been a real lack of adversarial pressure for cars. Cars today are sort of at the state that personal computers were just before the internet. They were full of bugs, even, you know, the simple stir copy bugs and so forth, but it didn't really matter because there wasn't a real convenient way to attack a bunch of computers at the same time. Once all of the computers joined the internet, it became a much bigger deal. And now, cars are increasingly becoming connected to the outside world, including the public internet. The second reason has more to do with the business model of the auto manufacturer. In particular, the way we understand this works is that they will write a spec for a component, outsource it to some supplier, who will then implement it and then return it as a completed box, a widget, if you will, to the auto manufacturer. And then the auto manufacturer finds itself in the role of an integrator. So they take a bunch of these widgets, they stick them together in a car, and then they test that they do what they're supposed to do. So one consequence of this is that the internals of these widgets are frequently unknown to the manufacturer. They don't have the source code for many of these. And so they can't do any sort of easy security audit, even looking at the code to make sure it doesn't have obvious vulnerabilities. Another consequence of this is that that leads to a bunch of incorrect assumptions between different suppliers. So the cellular attack was one prime example of this, where the supplier for the software modem decided that it could send long buffers, but the rest of the telematics code was written by someone who didn't need long buffers, and so they only used short buffers. And in fact, almost without exception, every single bug we found lay at the intersection of two components. So, where do we go from here? Well, fortunately, all of the relevant stakeholders are responding today. The Society for Automotive Engineers, the U.S. Council for Automotive Research, the leading automotive societies, at least in the U.S., have created working groups whose focus is cybersecurity in cars. And quite recently, the U.S. Department of Transportation has put out a request for information for cybersecurity in cars. Now, we can make a couple of concrete recommendations, some of which were learned, or lessons learned from the personal computer world. Things like stack cookies and address space layout randomization, while they wouldn't have defeated all of our attacks, they would have made our job a whole lot harder. There are some other things that we can suggest, like don't let the telematics unit receive calls. If you need to initiate a call, then maybe when it receives a call, it hangs up immediately and then calls back to a known number to communicate with the call center. Longer term, it's a lot harder to give recommendations, mainly because the auto industry has a whole lot of constraints that we as academics don't really understand all that well. One prime example is they have very low margins, and we found out that if you say, take a device, stick it in the car, it turns out that it costs a whole lot more than just the cost of the device times the number of cars you stick it in. And that's, I guess if you think about it, that's sort of obvious. You know, the mechanics have to be able to deal with it and so forth. But it means that we need to think a lot harder about the sorts of things that can actually be done that fit within the constraints of the system. And of course, there was that complex business model that I mentioned where we have the suppliers providing widgets. The real question, or the real thing we have to understand, though, is which of these constraints are hard constraints and which of them can be relaxed in an effort to improve the current situation. And finally, safety is really the most critical thing here. In some cases, if you have a component that detects it's under attack, for example, the radio, it can just stop working, and that's fine, because, you know, you can't hear the music, but that's okay. If your brake controller decides that it's under attack, it can't stop working. It's got to keep doing all of the things that it has to do. So, in summary, current automobiles have a rather broad externally facing attack surface, and that surface seems to be increasing all the time. We were able to demonstrate real attacks against a number of these attack surfaces, and these attacks led to compromising many safety critical systems. But the most important thing to take away from this is that industry and government and everyone who is interested in this is really taking it seriously. And as we understand it, many of the attacks I've described are simply not going to be possible going forward. So with that, thank you for your attention, and I would be happy to answer any questions. Ian?
So you mentioned some of your analyses were destructive to the components. What did you tell the mechanic?
Okay, so that's a great question. Some things, we just bought another one. In fact, I went through radios like nothing else. Until Carl made his debugger, I was going through several of them a day, almost faster than we could buy them. I have a whole stack of them in the lab. We did screw up a few things that required the car to go to the mechanic. I think Stefan said earlier today that he spent about $1,000 repairing our mistakes. As for what we told the mechanic, it was our fault. Please just fix it. We'll pay whatever it costs. Yeah.
Bill Cheswick, Shannon Labs. I have a question and a comment. The question is, I didn't notice on that list of people who were talking about this, the DOD. Do modern military gear use the same technology?
That's a great question. I don't know the answer to that.
All right. My comment then, if for further research, is you should use the Matt Blaze School of Research and go get an NSF or DARPA grant and buy a tank.
I know a number of people want to look at planes. We hadn't considered tanks, but, you know, sure, why not?
Hi, Steve. Nice work. But I had one comment about your analysis. So you say that a lot of this seems to stem from the fact that it's a heterogeneous, diversified chain of equipment makers and so forth. But in the opposite scenario, where it was really a homogeneous world, where there was only one manufacturer who made the whole car and made every car, don't you think we'd be in a much worse scenario? Because if there were any attacks against it, we'd all be dead?
We would all be dead. Why?
So
you're saying there's...
As opposed to this scenario where it requires a lot of work by some smart people to pull off the attacks that are specialized to one model of whatever this widget is.
I guess. I'm not sure. I haven't really thought about that. I guess if the different manufacturers each made their own thing, they would be able to look at the security sort of holistically, which was what we were getting at, rather than having one manufacturer make every car, if that's what you were asking about.
Well, right. So it seems like the diversity has both pros and cons.
Yes, absolutely.
That's all I'm getting
absolutely.
At. Thanks.
Hi, I was wondering just how much of the car can you control from the CAN bus or what have you? Because if you can, I assume you can turn the wheels and control the accelerator and the brakes, you can make cars that steal themselves.
That is a good point. Our car, we could not steer, and I don't think we actually looked to see if we could make it accelerate, just mostly because we didn't want to play with the engine control unit. That seemed like that might be a bad idea.
Thank you.
Yeah, hi, Steve. Rick Farrow. Could you go back to the countermeasures slide a few slides ago?
This one?
Yes. So you didn't quite finish that. I like some of the ideas, but you said remove unnecessary binary. So it had FTP telnet, NC, VI. You said there was a Linux or Unix in there someplace?
Yeah, the telematics unit was a Unix environment, and it contained a number of binaries like FTP and VI, which was really quite handy, actually.
Yes!
I mean, I could edit stuff right on the device. It was fantastic.
And was this an old version of Linux? Because, I mean, you know, since 2005, we've had ASLR and a lot of versions of Linux. So.
It was not Linux. It was a real-time operating system. That's Unix-like.
Got it. Okay. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Ed. Go. I have a related question about diversity. This telematics unit, is it used on other manufacturers' vehicles? Is it a standard part?
So my understanding is that basically every manufacturer has their own. There are a whole bunch of them. BMW, Assist, Mercedes-Benz, Embrace, Ford Sync, GM OnStar, Toyota Safety Connect, et cetera, et cetera. So,
but do these have common code within them made by a single OEM for these customized for the different manufacturers? Or how wide would an attack on a telematics unit be in its applicability? Would it work on BMWs and Audis or Chevys or some, you know, wide variety of vehicles?
So that's a great question. We only studied one particular make and model of a car, and so it's hard to say. I don't know is the answer, I guess.
Just a very pragmatic question. Where do I get the code to apply the brakes on the guy who's tailgating me?
You're going to have to develop that yourself, I'm afraid. Thank you. Oh.